Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into a really fascinating, maybe even difficult, American autobiography. It's The Education of Henry Adams, published after his death in 1918.
Yeah, it's an amazing book to tackle. Henry Adams, I mean, on paper, this guy is American success, right?
Totally. Born into, well, basically American royalty. Great-grandson of John Adams, grandson of John Quincy Adams, presidents in the family tree.
Exactly. And he wasn't just co-sitting on the name. He was a serious historian, a really influential professor back at Harvard, even a respected journalist.
Okay, so that sets up the big question, the thing that grabs you immediately. Why on earth did this man with that name, that education, all the connections you could want, why did he spend his whole life thinking he was, and this is his phrase, an utter and spectacular failure?
Well, that's the kicker, isn't it? That feeling of failure is really the engine driving the whole book. It's not a memoir bragging about achievements. No, no. It's this incredibly deep, sometimes really ironic, look at his own perceived shortcomings.
So his education, the title, it's not about schooling.
Not really in the conventional sense. It's about his lifelong and, in his view, completely failed search for a framework, a way to actually understand the world changing so fast around him.
Right. So our mission here is to kind of track this journey, this mind that felt, well, tragically out of place. He got the 18th century Enlightenment toolkit from his family.
The age of reason, stoicism, all that.
But then he gets dumped headfirst into the 20th century, the age of, as he called it, the dynamo. Technology, chaos, speed.
A world his education just hadn't prepared him for at all.
Let's start there with that family legacy. It wasn't just a name. It was a weight, wasn't it?
Oh, immense. You have to imagine growing up literally in the shadow of presidents in Boston and Quincy. American history wasn't just in books for him. It was like in the house.
So his whole upbringing, it was geared towards statesmanship, public service.
Absolutely. Enlightenment ideals, classical learning, a sense of duty. He was basically groomed for a kind of rational, ordered world of politics.
A world that was already vanishing by the time he was coming of age, right? We're talking the 1850s, the run-up to the Civil War, industrialization kicking into high gear.
Precisely. And that disconnect started early. There's this amazing story about his grandfather, John Quincy Adams.
The former president.
Yes. Young Henry, maybe 6 or 7, decides he doesn't want to go to school one day. Just refuses.
Okay, typical kid stuff.
But nobody yells at him. Instead, his grandfather, who's like 77 at this point, just comes, takes him silently by the hand, and walks him the entire way to school. Not a word.
Wow. What did Adams make of that?
He wrote about it later. He felt it was this act of submission, like he was a puppet, a mannequin, just being moved by this powerful, silent force of tradition and expectation he couldn't fight.
So even his formal schooling felt off.
Yeah.
Outdated.
Completely. He went to Harvard, 1854 to 58, you know, supposed to be the best education America offered.
Yeah.
He savaged it. Just absolutely brutal. Call it a place for social connections, mostly. Said it just piled up inert facts, but gave him, and I quote, neither knowledge, discipline, nor purpose.
Ouch. So the gateway to the Gilded Age felt useless to him.
Yeah, he felt totally alienated. His classical, rational training felt completely mismatched with the kind of rough-and-tumble, money-focused energy of the new industrial America.
Right.
It wasn't that he didn't know things. It was that his whole way of thinking felt obsolete.
So if Harvard was a bust, where did he actually get his education, the real-world stuff?
The first major turning point was London. It's diplomacy.
Ah, right. He went with his father during the Civil War.
Exactly. 1861 to 68, his father, Charles Francis Adams, was the U.S. minister to the U.K., a crucial post. Henry served as his private secretary.
Talk about being thrown in the deep end.
It was a masterclass in how power really works. Not the rational debates he'd expected, but, you know, rumor, backroom deals, economic self-interest, sheer irrationality, trying to keep Britain from backing the Confederacy.
So that's where the cynicism starts, the skepticism about power.
For sure. It was a gritty, disillusioning education in real politics. But he was good at it. And he did achieve, you know, conventional success later on.
Yeah, you mentioned he taught at Harvard.
He did. And he actually revolutionized history teaching there. He brought in the German seminar method, small groups, critical discussion, primary sources, really pushed his students.
And then he wrote that massive history, right? The 9 volumes.
The History of the United States of America. During the administrations of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. A landmark work, still highly regarded.
Okay, so successful professor, groundbreaking historian. But you said he saw these as hollow victories. Why?
Because, in his mind, he had perfectly captured a past the early Republic that had absolutely zero power to explain the crazy, accelerating present he was living in.
He'd mastered history, but history itself felt useless as a guide.
That's it, exactly. He felt like he understood the old rules just as the game completely changed.
This seems like a good point to bring up the big silence in the book.
Ah, yes. The void. It's striking. He just skips almost 20 years, from 1871 to 1892, roughly.
And hiding in that gap is the central tragedy of his personal life.
The suicide of his wife, Marion Hooper Adams, always known as Clover, 1885, a brilliant photographer, intellectual, hostess, her death absolutely devastated him.
And he never mentions her in the education, not even once by name.
Never. The silence is, well, it's deafening. It's this monument to a grief so profound he couldn't articulate it, couldn't process it within the narrative of his education.
How does that personal catastrophe, that silence, shape the rest of the book? It feels like it must have warped everything.
I think it did. It forced him away from the personal, the human scale. His own intellect, his love, his status, none of it could prevent this unbearable loss. So personal experience failed him too.
So he turns towards bigger forces. Impersonal theories.
Precisely. If the intimate world was chaotic and uncontrollable, maybe he could find order in the vast impersonal laws governing history, science, civilization itself. It's almost like he's trying to build an intellectual shield against emotional pain.
The way to cope with the personal by theorizing the universal.
That seems to be the psychological drive. And that desperate search leads him to Paris.
The Paris Exposition of 1900. This is where the dynamo comes in.
The climax of the book, really. He wanders into the Hall of Machines and he sees these huge 40-foot dynamos, silent, powerful, generating electricity.
And this hits him like a religious experience.
Yeah.
But in reverse.
Sort of, yeah. He sees the dynamo as the new god, a symbol of modernity. This immense, impersonal, almost terrifying force. He even calls it a moral force, like the cross was for early Christians.
But a force without spirituality.
Exactly. And he contrasts it directly with the Virgin Mary.
Why the Virgin Mary?
Because he'd spent time studying the 13th century cathedrals in France, especially Chartres. For Adams, the Virgin represented the spiritual unity, the focused faith, the feminine power that could inspire people to build something like Chartres.
And the dynamo couldn't inspire that.
Not in the same way. It represented multiplicity, fragmentation, raw power without a unifying belief system. He saw history moving from the Virgin's unity to the dynamo's multiplicity.
This sounds pretty pessimistic, right? Like a rejection of progress.
Oh, absolutely. He completely rejected the standard American belief in inevitable progress. He saw history governed more by physics, specifically the second law of thermodynamics.
Okay, quick refresher for us non-physicists. The second law is about
entropy. Basically, that energy dissipates, systems move towards disorder, you crack an egg, it doesn't uncrack itself, heat spreads out, it doesn't spontaneously concentrate.
And Adams applied this to society, to history itself.
He did. He developed what he called his dynamic theory of history. He argued that history is basically the story of energy accelerating but also dissipating, moving towards chaos and decay, just like heat in a closed system.
Wow. So civilization is doomed to run down. That's dark.
It's definitely bleak. And he added another layer, the law of acceleration.
Meaning change is speeding up.
Exponentially speeding up. He lived through the shift from horse-drawn carriages to telegraphs, then saw x-rays, radium, the beginnings of the automobile and airplane. For him, it felt like the pace of change was outstripping humanity's ability to comprehend or control it.
Like our understanding, our institutions are built for the horse and buggy era, but we're suddenly dealing with, well, dynamos and beyond.
Precisely. He predicted this acceleration would eventually just overwhelm us. Our social structures, our minds, they couldn't keep up. He feared a kind of societal breakdown because the gap between the power we wielded and our wisdom to manage it was growing too vast.
Okay, but couldn't you just say this is elitist pessimism, an old Brahmin lamenting that the world isn't simple anymore?
That's definitely a criticism leveled against him, and maybe there's some truth to it, but I think the core insight is less about inevitable doom and more about the danger of failing to adapt.
So it's a warning. Adapt or face the consequences.
Yeah. He was one of the first to really diagnose the psychological stress of rapid technological change. He saw that speed itself would become a defining challenge. His 18th century education wasn't just obsolete, it was fundamentally misaligned with the new reality.
So his failure to find a unified theory, that's the point.
In a way, yes. And that very failure, that struggle, is what makes the book resonate so strongly today. Because let's face it, who doesn't feel overwhelmed by the pace of change now?
Right. His problem is basically our problem, just amplified. You felt his knowledge was useless against the telegraph and electricity?
And when we're sitting here grappling with AI, climate change, information overload, things our own education's barely conceived of, we're all living in the accelerating world Adams predicted.
It becomes a kind of cautionary tale then, especially for anyone in a position of leadership or planning.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Relying on old models, old ways of thinking, when the reality has shifted so dramatically, that's dangerous. Adams teaches the need for intellectual humility, for constant adaptation, maybe even painful unlearning.
Admitting your education is obsolete might be the smartest thing you can do.
Paradoxically, yes.
Okay, let's try to boil this down. What are the key lessons we can pull from this really complex, sometimes contradictory, life and book? Let's start with an emotional insight.
I think it has to be about the profound loneliness of feeling intellectually adrift. And also the immense power of grief that lies unspoken. That huge gap in the book where Clover should be. It shows how personal trauma can fuel this almost desperate search for impersonal cosmic order. He needed a system to make sense of a heartbreak that defied sense.
Okay. And an intellectual insight.
That has to be the dynamo and the virgin metaphor. It's still such a powerful way to think about the tension we all live with, the conflict between, say, humanistic or spiritual values and the relentless, often impersonal forces of technology, economics, and materialism that drive so much of modern life.
It frames a core conflict really well. And finally, a universal insight. What's the practical takeaway?
That true education isn't a destination you arrive at. It's a lifelong process of adaptation. And maybe the most critical skill isn't knowing facts, but having the flexibility and, crucially, the humility to adjust to a world that's always going to be partly beyond our grasp, accepting uncertainty.
So admitting ignorance is the starting point for real learning.
That's what Adams ultimately teaches us through his own magnificent failure.
He really did turn that perceived failure into this defining work, capturing the anxiety of the 20th century, which feels even more relevant now in the 21st.
Yeah, he struggled to make sense of forces like electricity and X-rays. Think about today. What are your dynamos? Is it AI? Climate disruption? The sheer speed of information? What forces are shaping your world that your own education never prepared you for?
It's a sobering question. His story suggests that facing that obsolescence, admitting what we don't know and can't control, isn't weakness. It's the first necessary step towards a genuine, ongoing education. Something to reflect on.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.